Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we return a guest that's been on before, Robert Oscar Lopez, who is the compiler of a book called Jephthah's Daughters, Innocent Casualties in the War for Family Equality. Well, there's a recent study that supposedly said homophobia is caused by mental disease, a study out of Italy. And I must say, I have not read that study, but our guest, I believe, is familiar with it and can address this issue. Robert, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Jerry. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
All right. And before we get into the subject at hand, tell us just briefly about Jephthah's Daughters for those who may have missed the previous interview.
Well, Jephthah's Daughters was a pretty big undertaking. We had 17 contributors in our 57 chapters, all addressing the social impact of legalizing same-sex marriage and changing the definition of family. And so we look at all the people who were harmed by this legal definition, beginning with children and also women, the effect on women, the effect on global relations, particularly in the third world. And then we looked at the gay community itself and how they were harmed in a lot of ways by the imposition of this different kind of relationship on them. And then we talked about free speech and freedom of religion. So it was a pretty big undertaking. It's 500 pages, but we felt that it was worth that, you know, changing marriage is big enough that it's worth 500 pages. So.
And why did you decide to undertake this?
Well,
you personally. Okay, wait. You're in a bad cell right now. You're in a bad.
Can you hear me?
Not as well as I heard you before.
Oh, really? Okay. How about
okay,
now?
That's perfect. Perfect.
Okay. So, did you want to?
Yeah. Tell me about your background. Tell me about your background.
I was raised by a gay mother, and with the help of her lifelong female partner. And I was never adopted by my mother's gay partner, and I actually think that was good. And so I felt very much looking at these arrangements where now people want to create gay adoption, I felt like that was really at odds with my own experience because I knew how painful it was to not have a dad in my life, and I knew things would have been a lot worse if I had been put under the authority of my mother's partner as opposed to just simply having a loving relationship with them, with my mother's partner based on...
All right, now let me ask you... Okay, let me ask you a question. Did your mom love you, and did your mom's female lover love you as well?
Yes, yeah.
So there was love in that household, and yet there was still something missing.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point, yeah, of what I've been trying to get across to people is that It's not love is not enough. Love is not what makes a family. That's the biggest myth or the biggest error that popped up in the whole discussion, this idea that somehow love makes a family.
Wow. You know, I remember after the Supreme Court decision, all kinds of people, even some people who were professing Christians, you know, were sending out tweets saying things like love wins, you know, with the gay flag and stuff. And it was just,
right.
Obviously don't think that you obviously don't agree.
No, I absolutely don't agree. You know, I study American literature, early American literature.
So you're a college professor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. So I spent a lot of time looking at past examples where large numbers of people made really stupid mistakes. So that's how history works. Sometimes people just all get together and decide we're going to have a lapse in judgment, like slavery. You know, like sometimes you just make a big mistake, and that's what this was. I think a lot of people were sucked into propaganda and were convinced based on very bad research, which is, I think, ties into what we were going to talk about today, about how all of the research has been so skewed and so corrupted in academia that I consider the Obergefell decision completely invalid, not necessarily for the legalistic reasons that have been provided by other people in the commentary nationwide. I think it's invalidated because the research was invalid that it was based on. It was based on all of these studies that claimed that there was no impact on children. And I have much research that I've done that says the exact opposite, but my research was completely ignored and has been censored and punished by the academic institutions that have been given this kind of prestige and respect by the courts. So it's a huge issue. It's a very, very serious problem.
That is a great point. Okay, let's talk about homophobia and this recent study out of Italy.
Okay. Well, this is one of a series of studies that seem to come out, which really reflect the dysfunction within academic research. There was a study that came out of Italy which claimed that people who were homophobic tended to have higher rates of different psychiatric disorders. And it's just part of the past studies have claimed to have discovered that, you know, homophobes are more likely to be gay themselves, or homophobes are more likely to be authoritarian and fascist, and, you know, all of these different studies that come out that really, if you look at the sampling, who did they ask the questions to, what questions did they ask, who did they throw out of the sample, because there's always a certain amount of people that don't match their criterion for the sample. And when you have a field like social psychology, where this one came from, when you have a field that is so completely overwhelmingly dominated by one side of the political spectrum, mm-hmm. you know, it's impossible for the researchers to even see their own bias. They can't mm-hmm. see it. And so the studies are really bad. It's the same thing that happened with the same-sex parenting studies, where, you know, everybody was so dedicated to the idea of glorifying and, you know, justifying same-sex parenting because they believed that their gay friends should have had the right to marry, that they really did not come up with good statistical models, and they found they had very biased means of assembling their samples to give the survey a survey to. And so that's, I think, we see over and over and over again with the research. It's a problem that I think conservatives need to take seriously. But conservatives have had a hard time sort of getting going in terms of how are they going to start getting their voice back into the academy. You know, that I think is one of the big challenges facing us.
You know, it's funny. The old phrase comes to mind, he who frames the debate often wins the debate. Even just the whole concept of homophobia is repugnant to me. Now, I know some people who are homosexuals, and I know some people who are former homosexuals. And I don't hate any of them. I don't hate any of them. And yet, because I believe the Bible is correct and the Bible is true and the Bible does say that homosexual behavior is wrong, that doesn't make me, you know, one who hates homosexuals. I'm sorry. So in other words, I don't even buy the concept of homophobia.
Well, first of all, homophobia technically means your fear of the same.
Yeah, fearful.
You know, that's actually what the word roots mean, so it just doesn't even make sense etymologically. But, you know, then they kind of combine fear and hate, and they do that very specifically so that we begin with the assumption that somehow if you do hate somebody, that's because you have an irrational psychotic response like a phobia, or, you know, something that's totally irrational and just based in kind of gut emotion. And that's even before we get to the association of anything that you disagree with you somehow hate, right? I mean, so there's all these links between ideas, there's all these associations between words that are done before you even begin the discussion. And then you never get a chance to question the breakdown of the medical terminology or what the assumptions were. And so the whole discussion is kind of railroaded to the same conclusion. And it's a conclusion that tends to make all of the people who work in social psychology happy, you know. And it's a very petty kind of cliquish game. But unfortunately now it is having such a huge impact on us internationally because this research has fed the jurisprudence at the courts. And that's why I think it is very dangerous.
I totally agree. It's almost like, you know, everything is stacked against us, and but everything but the truth. I mean, for example, okay, you were talking about research. Look at the example of, or the issue of, are homosexuals born that way, and can they change? Yes or no? And, you know, people have the impression that, well, science has basically proven that they are born that way and they can't change. That has been, in a sense, the linchpin upon which all these different court decisions and cultural shifts have been made. And yet that, again, is not proven at all. And in fact,
no, exactly.
Just look at the example of twins. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, right. No, overwhelmingly, the evidence goes in the opposite direction, that it's not born that way, that it's at best there's a combination of some kind of epigenetic factors. You know, there might be something in your genes that predisposes you a little bit mm-hmm. more towards it, and then things in your environment trigger that. But the idea that people are going to be on one track of homosexuality for their entire life, that goes at odds with 3,000 years of cultural history. I mean, in ancient Greece and in Rome and in the medieval world and Renaissance England and all of these different places, there were, I would say bisexuality was very often the most common experience. There was a period of time when people had very close emotional bonds and intimacy with the same sex, and then when they reached a certain age and they could get married, they had a full heterosexual lifestyle. So unless you think that somehow our entire biology for the whole human race has changed sometime around 1920, it's impossible. You know, this is a completely unproven, and it's a prima facie false presumption that people are born with the disposition. It makes no sense. But people repeat it again and again and again, and then, you know, they just don't go back and question that assumption. So then they build new research models with that assumption baked into it. Mm-hmm. So all of it, it's all false. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's real. I would really suggest if you can get a copy of an article that just came out this week by Jonathan Chait, who's done a lot of really good work on this, in Heterodox, which is a blog where they just published it. And they said in the field of social psychology, they're almost at the point of no return, because a very high percentage of the social psychologists surveyed said that they would explicitly discriminate against a conservative in hiring or in publishing. And so once you have a closed priesthood that is excluding any other viewpoints, then none of the research that they produce will actually be useful. Yep.
This is just like, macro-evolution. This is like global warming, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's really quite tragic. But while we're on the subject of homosexuality, let's just mention briefly the studies about identical twins and the significance of that.
Right. Well, basically, for a long time, they had claimed that there were these identical twin studies where they found a set of identical twins who were separated at birth and then given up for adoption and raised in totally different environments and didn't know each other. And they claimed that all of the twins had the same sexuality. So if one twin was gay, the other one was also gay. This was the state of the research maybe like 20 or 30 years ago. And then people started coming up with better models where they would find more representative samples, where they would actually include all of the different respondents that they found rather than eliminating some, et cetera. And what they came up with was actually that the opposite, that most of the time the twins were different. And if one twin was gay, the other one was often straight. So it was a low correlation. And so that disproved the idea that genetics alone is responsible for people's attraction.
You know, even just one exception itself, but you're saying that there were many exceptions.
There were many, many, many. It was a low correlation. Yeah, it was more
that
often.
Is a very important point, because, in fact, that to me is definitive. That nails it. I mean, think about it. These are identical twins, not fraternal or whatever twins.
Right. Well, I think one of the things about it is that at the core, there is an assumption that has gone unexamined, which I think historical research disproves, which is the assumption that somehow there are gay people as opposed to gay behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the mid-19th century, that was not the assumption of anybody anywhere in the world. There was no discrete group of people who were identified purely by what they did sexually. That just was not... that's a very, very recent development in human civilization. And I think I believe that it came from the Victorian era, when there was a resurgence and a desire to kind of redefine Christian morality at the same time that Darwinism had become really big. And I think, part of Darwin's theories was the notion of instinct, so the idea that your behavior is inbred in you. You know what I'm saying? So it was a period when there was a great deal of obsession with classification, and there was a conflation of identity with behavior across the board. And there was also a big preoccupation with sex, because in Darwin's theories, of course, sexual reproduction is the whole key to the survival of the fittest. So I think when you combine a kind of attempt at reviving Christian morality with this unexamined science, you get this idea that instead of hating the sin and loving the sinner, somehow the sinner is the sin, and you label the sinner and you remove them from society. And that's really where the anti-gay oppression got very bad. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Was when, and then, but I think the irony is that 100 years later, in the Stonewall Rebellion, what you find is that the gay movement actually, they kept in place all of the assumptions about identity and about behavior that had led to their oppression, but they thought that they could just remove the oppressive part of it. So they still maintained the idea that somehow they were identified by their sexual behavior, and that made them different from other people, and that that was their whole being, was I am gay, instead of, okay, this is an activity that I enjoy doing. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. This is extremely well done. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. That had been a means of labeling and segregating and quarantining them in the past. Suddenly it became a means for them to claim their legal rights. And so I think that's part of why we're in this really confused discussion about homosexuality, is because the people who are using these definitions as a way to advance their legal rights, they don't even realize that they're applying the models that were created by people who really truly did hate them, you know, and who were applying a, I think, a very flawed form of Christianity, because it says clearly in the Bible that you love the sinner and you hate the sin. So the idea that somebody is their sin is just totally anathema to followers of Jesus Christ, you know?
Excellent. And I will also add that, and we don't have time to pursue this, but there is a large ex-gay movement alive and well, followers of Jesus Christ, who by his grace have been free from this. And in the meantime, Robert Oscar Lopez, as I said at the beginning of this segment, has compiled lots of research about the actual impact on same-sex couples, of same-sex couples on their children. Jephthah's Daughters is a book that he's compiled. His website is englishmanif.blogspot.com. Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
All right, bye-bye now.